It is said that more people live and die on Necromunda in a day than on some worlds in a century. Imagine a city so vast and ancient that it covers an entire planet. Imagine towers that scrape the toxic sky, built upon the ruins of thousands of years of industry and war. Now imagine living at the bottom of that city, where sunlight is a myth and the air itself can kill you. Welcome to Necromunda, the hive world at the heart of the Imperium of Man. This planet is often called the Jewel in the Darkness, an ironic title for a world so polluted and violent that even hardened Imperial commanders speak of it with a mix of awe and dread. But to the Imperium, Necromunda truly is a jewel, a priceless asset of industry and manpower, gleaming amid the void, no matter how caked in ash and blood it may be. A world built on industry and blood. Necromunda is a hive world in Segmentum Solar, not far in galactic terms from Holy Terra itself. It has one purpose: production. The planet's countless forges churn out laser guns, auto guns, bullets, and bombs without pause. Its factories refine fuel and chemicals. Its factorums assemble everything from basic tools to munitions for the Imperial Guard. This single world's output equips entire regiments and fleets. In return, the Imperium cares little how the job gets done, only that quotas are met. Billions of human beings are expendable fuel for the great machine of Imperial industry here. Life on Necromunda is cheap, but the weapons it produces are invaluable. The planet also provides flesh and blood to the Imperium, huge levies of troops for the Astra Militarum Imperial Guard. The Necromundan Guard regiments, famously called the Necromundan Spiders, are drawn from the toughest of its gang fighters and hive scum. Even the mighty Space Marines take notice of Necromunda the Imperial Fists. Chapter actually recruits some of its new warriors from this planet's fiercest youth. On Necromunda, every child knows that glory, or a quick death, might await if they prove themselves deadly enough to be taken off-world as a Space Marine candidate. From orbit, Necromunda doesn't look like a jewel at all. It's a gray-brown orb shrouded in a haze of pollution. Vast cloud banks of black smog swirl over its surface. The only breaks in the poisonous cloud cover are the jagged tips of Hive City spires poking through like the fingers of a drowning giant. Those spires are the world, for nothing natural remains below. Once upon a time, in epochs past, Necromunda had blue oceans and green plains. No longer. 15,000 years of strip mining and unbridled industry have gutted the planet's crust and filled its skies with toxins. The oceans were boiled off or turned to sludge lakes long ago. Mountains have been ground down to feed the forges. The very soil is poisoned. In their place rise the man-made mountains of Necromunda's hive cities. Tier upon tier of metal, concrete, and decay, reaching kilometers high. These hive cities are Necromunda's lifeblood and its bane, all at once. Ancient history, carved in ash. How did things get this way? To understand Necromunda's nightmare present, we must glimpse its past. This planet's recorded history spans over 15,000 years. It was originally colonized long before the Imperium existed, during humanity's distant age of expansion. Old records say Necromunda was once called Aranius Prime, capital of a small human empire known as the Aranius Continuity. Those bygone rulers were techno-nobles who presided over the early mining colonies here. Even then, millennia before the Imperium, Necromunda's wealth came from its mines and manufactories. But isolation and pride would not last forever. The Emperor of Mankind arrived with his great crusade around 30,000 AD, uniting or conquering the scattered worlds of humanity. The Aranius Continuity dared to resist him. Some legends claim they submitted peacefully to Imperial rule. Others whisper of a bitter war that scorched Necromunda's surface into lifeless ash. Either way, Araneus Prime was brought into Imperial compliance. To mark a new era, the Conquerors renamed the planet Necromunda, a name that would soon become synonymous with industry, decay, and constant conflict. During the Great Crusade, Necromunda also earned a special honor, or curse. It was liberated from an alien threat by the Space Marines of the Imperial Fists Legion. Xenos raiders, perhaps orcs, according to popular tales, had invaded the world through ancient warp gates, slaughtering the populace. The Imperial Fists under their Primarch, Rogel Dorn, intervened and purged the alien menace. In doing so, they cemented a relationship between Necromunda and the Imperial Fists that endures to this day. The people still celebrate this victory in an annual planetary festival, grimly nicknamed Imperial Fistmas, honoring the warriors who saved their ancestors. With the aliens gone and the Emperor's rule imposed, Necromunda was rebuilt as a loyal Imperial world. Some say it was devastated again during the Horus Heresy, and rebuilt yet again with help from hardy minor clans, even squat engineers if one trusts Underhive folklore. Through it all, one thing remained constant. Necromunda's purpose as a forge of war never changed. For 10,000 years of Imperial history, this world has churned out weapons, ammo, and recruits. The hive cities grew taller and the waste piles grew deeper, but the planet's role in the Imperium's grand drama stayed the same. Rulers in the Spire. For the last 7 millennia, Necromunda has been ruled by the noble house Helmar, one of the Imperium's oldest continuous noble dynasties. The planetary governor today is Lord Gerontius Helmar, the latest in a long line of tyrants, each as ruthless as the last. House Helmar secured its rule around the 32nd millennium, and they have never relinquished it. In the upper spires of the largest hive, the planetary capital, Hive Primus, Lord Helmar sits upon a throne of iron and profit. He commands absolute authority by the Emperor's decree. But the truth is that Necromunda is far too vast for one man or one family to control alone. Lord Helmar's rule is maintained through a complex web of sub-factions, alliances, and brutal repression. Feudal is the best way to describe Necromunda's society. It's like a patchwork of thousands of tiny kingdoms, all tenuously loyal to one High King in the Spire. The Helmar family's policy has always been divide and conquer. Encourage rivalries between the major powers of the Hive so none grow strong enough to threaten their overlords. Over the centuries, the real operational power on Necromunda came to rest in the hands of the great clan houses. These are enormous consortiums, or clans that control different industries and territories within the Hives. There are 6 major clan houses on Necromunda, each with its own identity, products, and private armies. They feud constantly with one another, yet together they form the bulk of Necromundan society. Think of them as both corporations and warrior tribes. They produce vital goods for the planet and the Imperium, but they also fight endless turf wars in the Hive. Here's a quick introduction to the Big 6. House Goliath, the masters of foundries and heavy industry. Goliaths are known for their gigantic physiques. Many are gene-forged or chemically enhanced to better toil in the furnace heat of the forges. They value strength above all. A typical Goliath ganger is a slab of muscle and aggression, wielding oversized weapons like chain axes and spud jackers. Their culture revolves around displays of brute power. If there's one language a Goliath understands, it's violence. They see themselves as the engine of Necromunda. Without their labor, the hives would crumble. Others just see them as barely restrained brutes. House Escher. If Goliath is muscle, Escher is sharpness, in more ways than one. House Escher is a matriarchal society composed almost entirely of women. Long ago, a genetic defect began killing off their male offspring, and over generations, the women of Escher took sole charge. They specialize in chemtech, drugs, and genetic research, much of it very illicit. Escher gang sisters are swift, deadly, and flamboyant, often armed with elegant blades, poisoned needles, or exotic cocktails of combat drugs. They're arguably the most ingenious when it comes to crafting toxins and stimulants. Underestimate an Escher as just a pretty face, and she'll happily demonstrate a neurotoxin that melts yours off. House Orlok. Known as the House of Iron, Orlok controls many mines and the transport routes of Necromunda. They're the closest thing Necromunda has to blue-collar everymen. Tough, disciplined, and pragmatic. Orloks make reliable soldiers and crafty traders. They deal in ore, metal, and manufactured goods, and they sit on the highways, both literal and figurative, that connect Necromunda's economy. In the hive hierarchy, Orloks often find themselves mediating between extremes, but when crossed, they can be as relentless as any other gang. Their gangs favor shotguns, stub guns, and fists wrapped in iron chains. Solid, stubborn, and often surprisingly honorable by hive standards, Orlok is the glue that holds a lot of trade together, and they'll fight tooth and nail to protect what's theirs. House Vansar, the technological artisans of the planet. Vansar produces the finest quality tech on Necromunda. Everything from intricate machine parts to advanced energy weapons. Their kit is coveted for its precision and power. Vansar's expertise comes at a price, though. Rumor has it they harness a unique and dangerously unstable ancient power source beneath their main hive, which slowly poisons them with radiation. As a result, many Vansar are frail or sickly, despite their high-quality equipment and bodysuits. Still, even a dying Vansar noble commands respect, because a laser gun from House Vansar's forges is often the difference between victory and death in the hive. These people live by knowledge and craft, prizing intellect, but they are just as ruthless in business and battle as any chem-crazed ganger when provoked. House Delac, the sinister shadow brokers. Delac controls information, espionage, and the kind of trade that goes on in the dark. Their agents are spy masters, assassins, and saboteurs. Physically, Delac gangers are gaunt, bald-headed figures with pale skin, rarely seeing the sun, and habitually wear long trench coats and visored goggles. They always seem to know more than they let on. If something explodes mysteriously in a hive factory or a gang leader falls dead to an unseen sniper, House Delac is often pulling the strings. They have a reputation for double crosses and secret dealings. Other houses openly despise them, but also fear their network of spies. In the Hive City, knowledge is power, and no one knows the hidden pathways and forgotten shafts of the Underhive like the Delacs do. House Cawder, the fanatical faithful and scrap hoarders. Cawder is sometimes called the House of Redemption, as they are utterly devoted to the Imperial Creed, particularly the more fiery, puritanical interpretations of it. They are hive rag pickers and recyclers by trade. Cawder clans reclaim mountains of trash and scrap, turning waste into usable goods. They even wear patched together rags and metal, along with trademark, featureless masks, so each member appears faceless and interchangeable in their devotion. What truly sets them apart is their zealous religion. They worship the Emperor with an almost insane fervor, and they consider it their holy duty to purify sin and heresy with fire and sword. Many Cawder gangers favor flamethrowers, crossbows firing explosive bolts, or simple blades weapons that feel ancient or symbolic. They willingly martyr themselves for their cause. To outsiders, they seem like maddened cultists, but to the downtrodden masses, the fiery sermons of Cawdor priests offer purpose in a hopeless world. These six houses dominate life in the hives. Virtually every hiver, hive city resident, is born under the umbrella of one of these houses or their allied lesser clans. Your job, your social identity, and often your lifespan are determined by house affiliation. The houses constantly scheme and battle for greater shares of production, territory, and influence in the eyes of Lord Hellmauer. Open warfare is rare. It's bad for business. But gang warfare by proxy is constant. Each house employs countless gangs of toughs and killers to do their dirty work, stealing resources, sabotaging rivals, or defending the house's holdings. In many ways, these houses and their gangs are the real engines that keep Necromunda running, or stumbling along at least. Lord Hellmauer simply sits atop this heap of squabbling factions, like a spider in a web, playing them against each other when needed and crushing any that defy the Imperial Order outright. Life in the Hive Cities. For an ordinary person, being born on Necromunda is a harsh fate. There is a popular saying in the Underhive, "On Necromunda, life is war." This is no exaggeration. From the moment you can walk, you must fight for every scrap of food, every breath of air, every hour of survival. Let's take a tour from the top of a hive spire to the very bottom and see what daily life might be like at each level. At the very top of a hive are the spire elites, the ruling family, and a tiny number of ultra-privileged nobles. These include Lord Hellmauer and other aristocrats, some tied to the great houses, others part of distinct noble lineages who have mansions in the sky. Up here, above the smog, the air is cleaner, often artificially filtered. The nobles live in opulent apartments, or even palaces, with access to gardens, rare hydroponic terraces with real plants, and banquets of off-world food. Yes, the incredibly wealthy on Necromunda actually import delicacies from other planets, fruit, meats, Amasek wine, things unheard of to the starving masses below. They throw decadent parties, dress in extravagant clothes, and plot politics endlessly. However, do not mistake the spire for a peaceful haven. Intrigue and assassination are rife among the nobility. A lord might smile at you over a golden dinner plate today and slip poison into your drink tomorrow. In this stratosphere of privilege, power is everything, and paranoia is the price of staying alive. Many nobles keep private assassins on retainer and wear hidden force fields or armor beneath their silks. Even a casual stroll on a spire balcony might mean wearing a rebreather mask. One gust of unfiltered wind can sear the lungs, and one stray bullet from below can end an aristocrat's lineage in an instant. It's rare, but it has happened. A gunfight hundreds of levels down sends a stray round up into the sky, and some bored noble leaning on a railing suddenly slumps dead, much to the surprise of their peers. On Necromunda, no one is ever truly safe. Descend a little lower and you reach the upper hive levels, just below the spire. Here live the middle managers of the nightmare, guilders, overseers, technicians, financiers, those who aren't top nobility but still enjoy a relatively comfortable life. They keep the factories running and the money flowing. These people might have small luxuries like cleaner water, personal bodyguards, or a bionic limb or two, replacing what they lost in an earlier, less privileged life. Many in the upper hive are affiliated with the mercantile guilds that control vital resources. The Mercator Guilds, such as the Water Guild, the Promethium Guild, Fuel, the Corpse Guild, the Slave Guild, and so on, operate at this level with Hellmauer's sanction. For example, the Water Guild ensures that recycled water gets distributed at a steep price to the lower levels. The Promethium Guild monopolizes fuel production, and the infamous Corpse Guild oversees the collection of the dead. Yes, that's right. Even the dead bodies of Necromunda serve the machine. In the upper hive, you might see cartel agents negotiating shipments of corpses to the rendering factories, where they'll be turned into corpse starch, a protein-rich synthetic food paste that sustains the hive's billions. It's a lucrative trade on Necromunda. Death literally feeds life in an endless cycle of cannibalistic necessity. And those guild representatives walking past in robes? They might smell a bit strange. The Corpse Guild meat wagon crews certainly do, but you don't dare wrinkle your nose. They hold your survival in their hands. Below the upper hive is the mid-hive, or industrial levels. This is the beating heart of production. Colossal factorum chambers stretch for miles, filled with ceaseless noise, the clanging of machinery, the roar of furnaces, the hiss of chemical vats. Entire hab blocks of workers cling to the sides of these factories or sprawl in adjoining districts. Here the air is hot, thick with fumes. Thousands of men, women, and juves, youth, labor in shifts that can last 14, 16, 20 hours, whatever their overseers demand. Many workers never see natural light. They live and die under the flicker of lumen strips and the glow of molten metal. Their skin is often ashen from pollutants, their lungs rattling with hive cough. Life expectancy for a mid-hive factory worker is brutally short. If an industrial accident or toxic exposure doesn't get you, malnutrition or gang violence might. Those who can endure often augment themselves. It's not uncommon to see grafted limbs or implanted tools on workers, the lucky ones sanctioned by their house, as such surgery is expensive and marks you as valuable property. Imagine a man whose arms have been replaced by hydraulic drills so he can bore into harder rock. That's the sort of extreme adaptation survival may require. The workers exist in a state of constant exploitation. They are paid in company scrip or meager rations, just enough to keep them functional. Hope is a dangerous concept here. Most have never known anything but the hive. They are born in the hab, toil next to their parents from childhood, and likely die before reaching old age. For diversion, there are intoxicants, many brewed by House Escher's chemists and sold freely. Better a doped-up workforce than a rebellious one. And there are fighting pits, or one of the few hive-wide sanctioned entertainments. Brutal arena fights between gang champions, or the occasional public execution of a heretic to remind everyone what happens if you defy the order. Security in the mid-hive is tenuous. The official enforcers, Necromunda's police, patrol some areas. These enforcers are typically well-armed, armored in carapace plating, and utterly uncompromising. They answer ultimately to Lord Helmar's justice. But there are never enough enforcers to cover every corner. So many mid-hive zones are effectively controlled by whichever gang or house has the strongest presence. If an enforcer patrol ventures somewhere they shouldn't, it might disappear, never to be seen again. Conversely, if a gang gets too bold in a protected zone, Helmar might send the enforcers in force to make an example, kicking down doors, cracking skulls, executing anyone labeled a criminal. The line between sanctioned house operations and crime is paper thin. A gang leader might be a respected house contractor one week and an outlaw shot in the streets the next, depending on Helmar's needs. This inconsistency breeds cynicism among hivers. Most people just keep their heads down, mutter a prayer to the God Emperor, and avoid drawing attention. They know that in Necromunda, survival is the only victory they can hope for each day. Further down we go, to the infamous Underhive. This is the world beneath the world. The lawless, forsaken bottom of the Hive City. The Underhive begins where the maintained structures end. Here lie collapsed manufactorum levels from centuries ago, flooded tunnels, abandoned domes that once were bustling markets or transport hubs but now serve as battlefields for mutant tribes. The ceiling is low or broken open to bedrock. Some areas are completely dark, except for bioluminescent fungi, or the flicker of barrel fires lit by desperate squatters. It's a terrible place to live, which is exactly why so many end up here. The Underhive is home to those cast out of society, exiled workers, fleeing criminals, unwanted mutants, escaped servitors, and descendants of those who, for whatever reason, ventured down and never returned. It is said that no one knows the full extent of the Underhive. It sprawls out for miles and miles below the active city, even extending under the ash wastes between hives via forgotten tunnels. Many sections have never seen a qualified tech priest or an enforcer's boot. They are effectively wild frontiers. And like any frontier, they breed their own kind of folk. In the Underhive, gangs reign supreme. Gangs that operate here might nominally have house affiliations, but many have gone outlaw, no longer welcome in the structured society above. Others are independent gangs formed by those who left or were kicked out of the big houses. There are also scavy gangs, mutant hordes often afflicted with hideous deformities from generations of radiation and toxic exposure. These scavies live on the margins, sometimes venturing uphive to raid and steal, then retreating to the darkness. They'll eat anything or anyone. Cannibalism is not taboo for them if it means survival. If you encounter a pack of feral, boil-covered humans wielding rusted cleavers and accompanied by, say, giant bloated rats, congratulations, you've met the scavies. Then there are the so-called redemptionists, often aligned with House Cawdor's creed, who come down here on self-proclaimed crusades to burn out sin. They are basically zealot gangs, setting fire to anything or anyone deemed impure. Mutants are their favorite target. Their witch hunters might actually be more terrifying than the mutants, because they are fanatically driven and absolutely merciless. In the Dance of Death, that is the Underhive, you'll also find tech denizens, people who scavenge old machinery, sometimes building bizarre contraptions or robots from scrap. A few Underhive areas are known as bad zones, so contaminated or unstable that even seasoned gangers fear to tread there. Imagine chemical rivers that can dissolve flesh, nests of predatory hive spiders the size of a man, or radiation hotspots that cook you alive if you linger more than a minute. These are the gentle warnings the Underhive gives you to stay alert. Amidst this deadly chaos, a few figures manage to become almost legendary. Underhive bounty hunters, for example, roam these depths in search of notorious fugitives or valuable bounties set by the authorities. One famous name often whispered is Cal Jericho, a dashing, roguish bounty hunter said to be the son of a spire noble who chose a life of adventure below. Tales of his sharp shooting and devil-may-care bravado are one of the few bits of hopeful legend down here, if you can call a gunslinging renegade hopeful. There's also the legend of Mad Donna, an ex-noble lady who went utterly psychotic, armed herself to the teeth, and decided to live among the gangs for thrills. She's become a sort of Underhive boogeyman, or boogeywoman, unpredictable, deadly, and utterly unafraid to take on entire gangs by herself. These larger-than-life characters aside, most denizens of the Underhive live short, brutal lives. They scavenge ancient ruins for anything they can trade, perhaps an old circuit board they can barter to House Vansar agents, or a cache of archaeotech weapons long forgotten under a collapsed dome. Such finds can make a person fabulously wealthy by hive standards overnight, or more likely get them killed by rivals trying to seize the prize. Let's not forget the ash wastes, the expanses outside the hive cities. If the Underhive is lawless, the wastes are virtually alien. The ground out there is an endless desert of gray ash and industrial powder. It doesn't behave exactly like normal sand. This ash is often laced with chemicals, so it can clump in glassy sheets or blow in razor-sharp storms. The ash dunes shift and slide with the howling winds. Poisonous dust storms, called dust tempests, can come up without warning, flaying exposed skin and clogging vehicle engines. Yet, life exists even in this hellscape. Nomadic ash waste tribes travel between the hive clusters. These nomads are descendants of those who long ago chose or were forced to live outside the hive walls. They ride rugged vehicles or sometimes domesticated giant insects and ash dune beasts. Wrapped head to toe in protective gear, an ash nomad looks more like a monster than a man, but they are human, just heavily scarred by the environment. They have their own society, trading scavenged or harvested materials like minerals from the wastes, or ambushing and looting convoys, in return for manufactured goods from the hives. The relationship between hive dwellers and ash nomads is uneasy at best, often outright hostile. Nomads might raid a poorly defended cargo shipment, or a hive might send out gangers on bikes to hunt down a nomad camp that strayed too close. Out in the wastes, beyond even the minimal order of the underhive, survival is a constant open question. If the environment doesn't kill you, the human or mutant predators will. Convoys that attempt to travel from one hive to another must be armed like military patrols. And even then, many simply vanish into the gray. Stories abound of what might lurk in the far reaches of the wastes. Gargantuan mutant worms beneath the ash, perhaps, or ancient war machines left from long-forgotten battles, still roaming under auto-control. True or not, when the night falls in the ash desert and your Geiger counter ticks up, fear comes naturally. Faith, fear, and factions. Despite all this horror, or perhaps because of it, religion is deeply ingrained in Necromundan culture. The Imperial Creed, the worship of the God Emperor of mankind, permeates daily life. In the upper levels, grand cathedrals pierce the hive spires, and Helmar maintains a close alliance with the Ecclesiarchy, Imperial Church, to keep the populace in line. Missionaries and preachers are everywhere, from the gilded priests in Hive Temenos, a hive entirely given over to religious devotion and the Ecclesiarchy's headquarters on planet, to the ragged street-corner zealot shouting damnation in the lower hive bazaar. Necromunda has even produced its share of saints and holy figures, individuals who performed such acts of faith, or fanaticism, that the church elevated them as examples. Some are officially recognized across the Imperium, but many are local heroes. In the Ash Wastes, for example, stories tell of an angelic figure who led refugees to an oasis and then vanished, perhaps a manifestation of the Emperor's will. In the Hive Depths, a very different sort of saint might be celebrated, one like Saint Mina, said to have slaughtered 1,000 heretics, or Valdor the Blessed, a hero of some long-ago battle, now prayed to by underhivers who clutch ratty little icons bearing his name. For House Cawdor especially, such saints and martyrs are an obsession. They categorize and venerate a whole pantheon of them. At the same time, Necromunda breeds heresies just as easily. Where faith is fervent, so is the temptation of cults. Chaos cults, Genis Stealer cults, heretic cults, those who worship forbidden technology or knowledge, all find cracks in the society to grow. Perhaps a factory worker's prayers seem to go unanswered, but a secret cult promises immediate rewards at a terrible price, naturally. Or a desperate underhive family might take in a stranger who offers them food, not knowing that stranger carries the gene taint of a Xenos, and is converting them into a new brood of the four-armed emperor. One nickname for the patriarch of a Genis Stealer cult, masquerading as a religious leader. The authorities officially deny that such things happen, but when evidence becomes too blatant to ignore, they respond with overwhelming force. An outbreak of a Genis Stealer infestation in one of Necromunda's hives a century ago, Hive Secundus, once the planet's second largest city, led to an inquisitorial purge of apocalyptic proportions. Hive Secundus was bombarded, and its central spire gutted, collapsing levels and sealing the infestation below. The Hive was completely quarantined. To this day, Hive Secundus lies in ruins, patrolled only along its perimeter by grim-faced Imperial Guard conscripts and penal legions who have the unenviable duty of making sure nothing comes out. And still, within the blackened wreck, survivors of the cult and Emperor knows what else scuttle in the dark, an open wound in Necromunda's body. It stands as a warning of what happens when the darkness under the Hive grows too bold. For the common populace, these grand events are mostly rumor and distant fear. More immediate is the daily litany of minor sins and redemptions. If your factory quota wasn't met, you might attend a mandatory prayer session led by a Cawdor priest to beg the Emperor's forgiveness for your weakness. If your child is born with mutations, alas, an all-too-common occurrence due to pollution, Imperial doctrine demands the mutant be taken away, given to the Emperor's mercy. In reality, many such rejected children either end up recycled by the Corpse Guild or dumped in the Underhive if they're lucky. This harsh religious conformity keeps most Hivers on a knife's edge of guilt and fear. Yet, it also offers comfort. The idea that all this suffering has a purpose, that in the God Emperor's grand plan, even a poisonous hellscape like Necromunda has its place. It's a thin thread of hope to cling to. But in darkness as deep as this, even a dim candle can be salvation. The economy of survival. Let's talk a bit more about the economics of Necromunda, not the throne gelts and off-world trade, which Hellmauer's accountants handle in lofty halls, but the street-level reality. Nothing is free on Necromunda, not even the air you breathe. In the upper Hive, rich nobles might pay for filtered, scented air to be pumped into their dwellings, while down-hive families cough on smog and coal dust. Water is rationed. Many settlements have a water guild allowance, and if you need more, you barter for it or steal it. Food most people eat is a revolting gruel made from recycled organic matter, corpse starch broth, algae cakes, maybe some mushrooms cultivated in wastewater. If you're very lucky or favored by a house, you might get a bit of vat-grown protein that almost tastes like meat. Actual meat from animals is unheard of for the masses. Necromunda doesn't waste biomass on raising livestock. There are some creatures, vermin like hive rats or sump crocs, that people might catch and roast, but one takes a great risk eating anything that's grown up, chewing industrial waste. You might end up with a gut full of toxins or parasites that will finish you off. Still, in the Underhive, the smell of grilled sump rat can draw a crowd and likely a fight over the scraps. Every single item, every drop of resource, is part of a cycle of reclamation. The Hive produces an endless stream of garbage and pollution, but within that waste are materials to be extracted and reused. Entire clans exist just as garbage processors. Cawdor, as mentioned, built an empire on trash. Their workers comb through the mountains of detritus for anything useful. Plastic fragments, cloth fiber, spent munition casings, human hair. Absolutely everything can be broken down and repurposed. The saying, one man's trash is another man's treasure, is literally true here. One man's corpse becomes another man's ration bar. One factory's smoke emissions become another clan's chemical reagents, skimmed from the atmosphere by precipitating devices. A broken tool might find its way to a scrap market where a clever scavenger will patch it up and sell it to someone in the Underhive, who in turn uses it to fix a broken pump. The efficiency is brutal and born of necessity. Necromunda long ago ran out of virgin raw materials. It must cannibalize its own waste or die. This makes the entire society a bit like a snake eating its tail. It works until it doesn't. There is an underlying fear that one day Necromunda truly will have nothing left to scavenge. Perhaps then they will tear each other apart for the last scraps, or simply begin to die off. It's the unspoken doomsday scenario, but most dismiss it. After all, for 15,000 years they've managed to keep going. Why not 15,000 more? Such is the stubbornness and short-sightedness of humanity. Conflict as a way of life. By now, it should be clear that violence is the common thread through all aspects of Necromundan existence. But it's worth emphasizing just how normalized conflict is here. Children in the sump learn to fire a gun before they learn to read, if they ever do read at all. Duels and shootouts settle disputes more often than any court or arbitration. The very social structure encourages feuds. Houses test their strength constantly, gang against gang. A young hiver coming of age likely faces a choice: join a gang or get trampled by one. Those who try to stay entirely neutral and unaffiliated often become victims sooner or later, because without the protection of a larger group, you're prey. Some become lone bounty hunters or drifters, but even they must network with gangs or guilds to get by. What does a typical gang fight look like? It could be as small scale as an ambush in a maze-like corridor, a half dozen Orlok youths trying to jump an equal number of Delake agents over a shipment of ammo. Las shots sear through the darkness, blades flash, someone falls from a catwalk screaming. It's short, nasty, and usually ends with the losers dead or scattering. Or it could explode into something bigger. Two gangs trigger a chain reaction of revenge killings and neighborhood clashes that escalates to a full-blown gang war across several hive levels. When that happens, the area becomes a war zone. Businesses shutter. Any that weren't fronts for the gangs, anyway. Civilians hide in their habs or else arm themselves to avoid being collateral damage. The local manufacturer might slow to a crawl because half its workers are out fighting or too afraid to commute through the battle zone. That's when Helmar's authorities might step in, not out of compassion, but because production is being affected. A detachment of enforcers or even the armored Palanite subjugators, heavily armored riot troops, will storm in with shields and assault shotguns to crack heads until peace, by which we mean quiet productivity, is restored. More often, though, gang wars burn themselves out. The houses broker a truce when each side has lost too much. Or one side decisively crushes the other and takes the turf. The factories resume full operations soon after, possibly under new management of the victorious house. It's important to note that to a Necromundan, this level of violence isn't exceptional. It's just life. Your grandparents probably fought in a gang war, your parents too. If you're young and tough, you assume you'll do the same. Some gangs span generations, effectively becoming families that carry grudges for decades. Storytellers in the drinking holes might boast how their gang's founder slew an enemy leader back in the day, so now they keep the skull hung in their hideout as a trophy. Trophy taking itself is a big part of the culture, cutting off a finger or ear from a defeated foe, or painting kill markings on your jacket or armor. A seasoned ganger might rattle when he walks from all the finger bones strung on his belt. Morbid, yes, but it's their way of showing status. One particularly grisly custom known as scragging is when a new recruit is only fully accepted after they've taken a trophy from an enemy. Usually it's done from a corpse, but the boldest will try to snatch something from a still-living, perhaps dying foe. It's a dangerous brag, basically. Many a would-be hero lost their life trying to carve a trophy off an opponent before the fight was truly over. The survivors, though, earn a fierce rep. If you ever meet someone from Necromunda who has all 10 fingers intact, it means something remarkable. Either they're incredibly powerful or incredibly lucky. In Necromundan ritual, losing a finger is often the price of failure or shame. A worker who botches a job, a lieutenant who disappoints their boss. They might voluntarily cut off a fingertip or whole finger as an act of contrition, presenting the bloody digit to their superior to show they accept the blame and will not repeat the mistake. This is seen as atonement, and also a warning to do better. Thus, someone with all fingers showing is essentially saying, "I have never failed, challenge me at your peril." It's a bravado display. In fact, as a greeting or intimidation tactic, tough fighters will sometimes flash their open palms outward so you can see all their fingers, a wordless way of saying, "Look, I've never had to pay for a mistake. I don't lose." Usually it's a bluff, of course. Plenty of folks with all their fingers just haven't been caught for their failures, but the psychological effect often works. Nobody wants to find out the hard way if you're telling the truth or not. The horrors in the depths. As if human threats weren't enough, Necromunda has its share of other dangers. Centuries of pollution have created horribly deformed wildlife. Giant mutated rats infest the lower levels. Some carry diseases that can wipe out whole habstacks if unchecked. Enormous arachnids lurk in the sump tunnels, pale, blind, and hungry, able to sense the slightest vibration of prey. Some hivers capture these creatures for gladiatorial combat, or in the case of a particularly entrepreneurial gang, perhaps to milk them for venom, to sell to Escher alchemists. There are also ancient manufacturing byproducts that gained a life of sorts. Swarms of carnivorous insects bred in chemical vats, or the infamous caryatids. Strange blue-skinned, cherub-like flying things that flit about the spires. Caryatids are a mystery. They might be a type of mutant animal or something warp-touched. They have small wings and eerily human-like faces with big black eyes. Oddly, they seem drawn to powerful individuals. A lord in the upper hive might find one perched in his chamber, cooing softly. Far from shooing it away, he'd consider it a good omen. These creatures are thought to be lucky mascots. They tend to attach themselves, figuratively, to those on the rise, so seeing one hovering near a hiver has even led people to think that person is marked for greatness. Superstition? Perhaps. But on Necromunda, people will take any edge they can get, even if it's a weird blue imp watching over them. And then there's the warp. Yes, the influence of chaos does seep into Necromunda as well. Amid the despair and bloodshed, some foolish or malign individuals turn to arcane cults. The most notorious in recent times are the Corpse Grinder cults. These start as splinter sects of the Corpse Guild or desperate meat factory workers who develop a taste for blood. Literally. They worship chaos, specifically the blood god Khorne, through ritual cannibalism and mass murder, donning horrific blood-spattered butcher's masks. A couple of decades ago, one such cult incited an uprising in Hive Arkos that got so out of hand the hive had to be abandoned. When these cultists rampage, they don't just kill. They process the victims in grisly imitation of the corpse starch factories, hanging bodies on meat hooks and rendering them. The fact that normal hive life is so close to this, the line between dutiful corpse recycling and blasphemous corpse grinding is thin, makes it especially terrifying to the authorities. It's heresy that hits too close to home. So they respond mercilessly. Any suspected corpse grinder cult is exterminated by special Palanite enforcer kill teams, or even Space Marine assistance if needed. Similarly, rogue psychers, called wireds, in underhive slang, gather in secret covens known as psi syndicates. These unsanctioned witches can cause all kinds of havoc, from starting fires with a thought to summoning warp entities if truly corrupted. House Delac, in particular, is often suspected of dabbling with such things, given their penchant for secret knowledge. As a result, Inquisitors do pay attention to Necromunda, though they prefer to let Helmar deal with minor insurrections and only step in for the gravest threats. The Inquisition knows that hive worlds are powder kegs. A wrong move could ignite planet-wide rebellion or disaster. Necromunda had a brush with that during the recent formation of the Great Rift, the galaxy-wide warp rift in late M41. When the lights of the Astronomicon faltered and demons poured into real space across the galaxy, Necromunda was thrown into panic. A massive rebellion erupted, downtrodden workers seeing a chance to throw off their lords amid the chaos. It might have become full-scale revolution, but word came down that none other than Robute Guillemon, the reborn Primarch, was leading the Indomitus Crusade through Segmentum Solar to restore order. The prospect of facing the Emperor's own Genesun and his armies was enough to make the rebels lose their nerve. Helmar's loyalists crushed the remaining dissent in short order. By the time Guillemon's fleets arrived, Necromunda was obediently churning out munitions again, as if nothing had happened. Still, one imagines Lord Helmar had some very pointed executions carried out afterward to drive home that such betrayal must never happen again. Stability, after all, is the key to keeping the production lines moving. Conclusion. The hive heart beats on. This is Necromunda. A world of unending industry, unimaginable population, and unrelenting struggle. It is the rotting heart of the Imperium's war machine, pumping out weapons and warriors as blood flows from an open wound. Dystopian? Absolutely. Realistic? Tragically so. In the Imperium of Man, billions live in conditions just like this, or worse, all in the name of survival and the Emperor's glory. Yet, Necromunda endures. Through toxic air and toxic politics, through gang wars and guild intrigues, through demonic threats and human folly, the hive world keeps grinding on. For the average Necromundan, there is no concept of retirement or escape. The only hope is to rise one level higher, maybe earn a promotion in the clan, move your family to a slightly less deadly part of the hive, or, with the Emperor's blessing, have a child accepted into the Schola or the Imperial Guard. At least they'll leave the planet, even if it's to die on some far-flung battlefield. And strangely, there is pride, too. A Necromundan knows their world is crucial to the Imperium. They know that without their output, some front line somewhere would go without rifles. Some crusade might falter. This harsh sense of purpose drives them as much as fear or faith. They might say, "Hive City Necromunda in the heart of the Imperium. We bleed so the Imperium does not." It's a grim boast, but not an empty one. Our journey through Hive Primus and beyond has only scratched the surface of what could be said about Necromunda. Every corridor in this world has a story, every gang an oath, every noble a scheme. In the Hive's bowels, tales of heroism and horror alike are written in bullet holes and graffiti. It is an ecosystem as rich and violent as any jungle. Only the predators and prey are all human, or once human. The next time you chamber a round in your laser gun, if you're an Imperial Guardsman, or say a prayer of thanks for the weapons defending your planet, spare a thought for the wretches of Necromunda who forged those tools in fire and blood. In the Imperium, someone always pays the price for humanity's survival, and on Necromunda, they pay in pain daily. Thank you for taking this perilous tour of Necromunda's hive world reality. But don't climb back up the spire just yet. Our exploration isn't over. This has been merely the introduction, the wide-angle view of the Nightmare City. In the next installment of this series, we'll descend once more into the depths. This time to focus on one of Necromunda's notorious houses in detail. Coming up next, the brutal world of House Goliath. The gene-forged giants of the Underhive, masters of muscle and molten metal. How did a clan of slave-born brutes rise to power, and what secrets smolder in their forge temples? Join us next time to find out. Until then, watch your step, keep your gun handy, and never forget, on Necromunda there are no bystanders. Every day is a fight to survive, and the Hive always wins in the end.